I asked if it could be another spaceship. No, Almuth said with a smile, but did not explain further. Also, I noticed that now and then dark objects of various sizes, darker than space itself, would pass. But none of these moving objects seemed to touch the ship. At times, even the dark objects would become partially luminous. These, I was told, were what we call meteorites, which become visible to us on Earth only as they create friction in passing through our atmosphere. I asked what prevented them from striking the ship when seemingly they were headed straight for it. The ship itself, Firkn explained, is utilizing the power of nature, electromagnetic, I think you call it, and has excess power at all times. Some of this excess is dissipated through its skin out into space for a certain distance, sometimes only a short way, although at times its influence can extend for several miles outward. This acts as a shield against any particles, or space debris, as you on Earth term it, repelling such things by this constantly radiating force. He went on to explain that all bodies in space are negative to space and are actually moving in a sea of electromagnetic force. Therefore, a negative radiation repels all negative bodies while at the same time it prevents the ship from heating through friction. I could have stayed for hours enjoying this beautiful sight, but only a short time was allotted before the pilots resumed their seats and we returned to the 40,000-foot altitude where the ship had been hovering when first we arrived. There was no perceptible dip nor turn in the ship's motion. The craft's movement was so gentle as to be scarcely noticeable, and the only audible sound was something as slight as an electric fan in operation. None of us had been provided with special headgear or any device for breathing or balance, but my mind was clearly alert in every way at all times. I was struck by the fact that all the instruments I had so far seen throughout the ship appeared to be operated by push buttons. And nowhere did I see anything that even faintly resembled a weapon of destruction. But, after watching the repelling force of nature in space as controlled by radiations from the ship, I had a strong feeling that this force could very effectively be used for self-protection, should such a need ever arise. Firkn answered this thought by saying, "Yes, that is so. As yet, the need has not arisen. Moreover, if the issue is merely our lives as against the lives of our brothers, even those belligerent ones of your Earth, we would allow ourselves to be destroyed rather than to slay a fellow being." The implications of this simple statement affected me deeply. I could not help but reflect sorrowfully on the so different viewpoint of my fellow men on Earth, of the divided peoples, the nations even now engaged in a race to produce more dreadful weapons of destruction which would bring death, affliction and sickness to ever-increasing millions of their fellow beings throughout the world. I thought of the credo of hatred for the enemy instilled in the minds of young men as a necessary part of preparing them for killing. For it is not inherent in natural man who understands even a little of his place in creation to want to kill. I thought of the indescribable blasphemy of prayers addressed to the loving Eternal Father of all, asking him to bless them in thus betraying the very humanity of their heritage. Both Almuth and Firkn were silent while these thoughts went through my mind. Although I had many times before reflected on just these things, they had never penetrated my consciousness with such poignancy, and I knew that it would remain with me always. In a moment, Firkn called my attention to an instrument no larger than an ordinary cabinet radio, with a screen similar to a TV set. With this, he explained, we can picture and register anything taking place on the Earth, or on any planet over which we either pass or hover. Not only do we hear the spoken words, but pictures are picked up and shown on the screen. An internal mechanism breaks these down into sound vibrations, which are simultaneously translated into words of our own language, all of which are recorded in a manner similar to your own tape recordings. To further clear this for me, he explained that all words are made up of vibrations or scales similar to a musical octave, just as all melodies are composed of certain notes. By knowing this law, one can learn a heretofore unknown language in a short time. When strange vibrations become apparent, these are transposed into picture form, showing exactly what the strange words or their vibrations mean. Needless to say, the tape he showed me was different from any I had ever seen on Earth. It all sounded to me like a jigsaw puzzle, and my mystification no doubt showed plainly on my face. In any case, Armath laughed merrily and asked, "Would you be surprised to learn that races of people who lived on your Earth many centuries ago thoroughly understood and used the universal laws of sound and vibration?" I stated that I had long suspected the truth of this. "Although this knowledge is utterly lost to your present-day civilizations," Armath continued, "a few individuals here and there are awakening to a slight conception of its possibilities. On other planets, these laws are a fundamental teaching in the educational systems. With these as a basis, pupils are able to learn very rapidly in all fields of knowledge and expression." At this point, Firkin said, "Now we must return to the lounge," and as I stepped back to let Ulmuth precede me, I asked why it was that practically no movement was felt inside this large craft when she had risen from the 40,000-foot level to 50,000 miles. "Quite simply because the ship is built to take care of all that," Firkin answered, and added, "as is done with your own submarines." Again I was amazed to find how much these people knew about us and our developments on Earth. "Your submarines," he went on, "move under the surface of the water at great depths, yet the crew feel relatively little of the movement registered by their instruments. And the men are quite comfortable, too, for your ships have been carefully planned. Actually, there is not so much difference between a ship that goes underwater and one that travels through outer space, except that our ships are propelled by natural power, while yours are dependent on artificial forms of power." It seemed to me that the difference he mentioned was quite a tremendous one, but I did not say so, and Firkin continued. "When you learn how to use the natural source of power that is everywhere in the universe, you too will be able to build submarines which, like some of our craft, can rise to the ocean's surface and continue on up through the atmosphere out into space." This reminded me of two incidents reported early in 1951. In the first, two missiles dropped out of a perfectly clear sky into the waters of Incheon Bay, off the western coast of Korea. The missiles fell close to an anchored seaplane tender, the Gardner's Bay, and caused columns of water to rise to an estimated height of 100 feet. Later, the report said, the missiles were seen to rise again from the water and soar on up until lost to sight. The second incident happened off the coast of Scotland and was almost identical with the first. Firkin, obviously getting my thought, said, "You were quite correct in naming the photograph you were able to take of this kind of ship the submarine type." At this point we entered the large salon in which we had left Tram sitting with the older man. They were still there and speaking in their own tongue. As we approached, they rose, walked toward a small table around which were a number of chairs and motioned us to join them. These chairs were rather like dining room or office chairs, but proved far more comfortable. As we seated ourselves, Kalna and Orthan joined our group. On the table were crystal goblets filled with a clear liquid which I found very refreshing. The flavor was delicately sweet with an elusiveness that was tantalizing. The consistency was slightly heavy, of a type to be sipped. I was told the name of the fruit from which this juice was extracted, but could think of no comparable earthly flavor. The entire time that had elapsed since leaving the Earth to this moment probably was not much more than an hour, but in that little space of time my whole life and understanding had opened to a far greater concept of the universe than I had gained during the 61 years of my total life on Earth. Now, as we sat around the table, all eyes turned to the older spaceman as he began to speak. Although it was only later that his stature on all planets was explained to me, it was impossible not to realize that I was in the presence of a greatly evolved being, and the attitude of all present clearly indicated that they, as well as I, felt very humble before him. I learned that his age, in his present body, was close to 1,000 years. The following hour or so, during which he talked to us, seemed as a minute. All listened with complete attention and without interruption to this man of great wisdom. "Meeting with a master, my son," said the great teacher, "you have been brought here and shown what lies within our smaller craft and this large carrier. You have traveled in each for a short distance only, but far enough to give you much knowledge to pass on to your fellow men on planet Earth. You have seen what outer space is like and that it is indeed constantly active, filled with moving particles from out of which all forms are finally brought into being. There is neither a beginning nor an ending. In the vastness of space there are innumerable bodies which you on Earth call planets. These vary in size, as do all forms, but they are very much like your own world and ours, and most of them are peopled and governed by forms like yourselves and like us. While some are just reaching a point where they are capable of supporting such forms as ours, others have not yet reached that stage of development in their growth. For you must understand that worlds are but forms, and they to go through the long period of growth which all forms experience, from the smallest to the largest. Each planet moves in coordination with a number of other planets around a central sun, in perfect timing, forming a unit or what you would call a system. In each case, so far as we have learned from our travels, there are 12 planets in a system. Beyond that, 12 such systems are united around a central core comparable to our sun. These make up what some of your scientists call a constellation. Further constellations make up a galaxy, and many galaxies make up a universe, and such island universes comprise a vast unit in the Father's house of many mansions, and so on, without end. On our planet, and on other planets within our system, the form which you call man has grown and advanced intellectually and socially through various stages of development to a point which is inconceivable to the people of your Earth. This development has been accomplished only by adhering to what you would term the laws of nature. In our worlds it is known as growth through following the laws of the All-Supreme Intelligence which governs all time and space. As you have seen, we travel space as easily as you cross a room. The traversing of space is not difficult to those who have mastered the laws within which all bodies live and move, planets and men alike. It is then understood that distance between two such bodies in space, or that between worlds, is no distance at all as you conceive of distance in your world. Remember, at one time the distance between the bodies of land on your Earth, which you call continents, was considered great, and much time was required to travel from one to another. Now your aircraft have shortened this distance to a relative fraction of the time required in days past. Yet the distances are the same. And so it will be as you extend your knowledge and learn the laws operating in infinite space. Another aspect of which as yet you have no conception is that the body of any human being can be as comfortable on one planet as on another. While there are some differences in atmospheric conditions, depending upon the size and age of the planet, these are little greater than those which you experience on your Earth between sea level and on a mountain several thousand feet high. Certain people are affected by such changes, more than others, but all can become acclimated in time. Recalling the popular conception of ponderous headgear plus tubes and gadgets, as depicted all the way from the comics to serious theories of supposed experts, I wondered if our world was the lowest in development throughout the universe. Reading my thought and continuing without interruption, this great teacher said, "No, my son, your world is not the lowest in development in the universe. Yours is the least developed of those in our own solar system, but out beyond there are some worlds whose peoples have not yet grown to your standard, either socially or scientifically. Also, there are worlds where development has gone far in the field of science and remain low in the field of personal and social understanding, even though space has been conquered. In our solar system, the peoples of all planets except your Earth are traveling space freely, some for short distances only, while others achieve great distances that take them to systems beyond our own. Your understanding of life and the universe is very limited. As a result, you have many false concepts about other worlds and the composition of the universe, and so little knowledge of yourselves. But it also is true that there is a growing desire on the part of many on Earth who seek sincerely for greater understanding. We who have traveled the path you now are treading are willing to help and to give of our knowledge to all who will accept it. The first fact your people must realize is that the inhabitants of other worlds are not fundamentally different from Earth men. The purpose of life on other worlds is basically the same as yours. Inherent in all mankind, however deeply buried it may be, is the yearning to rise to something higher. Your school system on Earth is, in a sense, patterned after the universal progress of life. for in your schools you progress from grade to grade and from school to school, toward a higher and fuller education. In the same way, man progresses from planet to planet, and from system to system toward an ever higher understanding and evolvement in universal growth and service. As he gave this illustration, I understood him to mean that individuals on Earth would, when ready, advance to a planet of higher development. I wondered if, one day while still living on this Earth, we would learn the laws that govern space and be able to visit these other worlds as they now could. The Master gave no specific answer to my mental question, but continued, "You and Earth are bound by what you call time. But even according to your estimations of time, when you achieve space travel you will be astonished at the swiftness with which you can reach other planets. For this adventure you will have to find new words. You speak of our craft, you call them saucers, as flying, a term which applies to the operation of your own planes. But we do not fly as you mean it. We nullify the atmosphere by an electromagnetic procedure. You express it as suspending gravity. In this way we are not hindered by atmospheric interference or resistance. This is why our craft are able to make the sharp changes in direction of travel and to move at the speeds that have so mystified your airmen and your scientists. We could tell you much about the control of gravity, knowledge that is necessary both for safe leaving or approaching any planet. We would gladly give you this knowledge which had served us so well, except that you have not yet learned to live with one another in peace and brotherhood, for the welfare of all men alike, as we have on other worlds. If we revealed this power to you or to any Earthman and it became public knowledge, some of your people would quickly build ships for space traveling, mount guns upon them and go on a shooting spree in an attempt to conquer and take possession of other worlds. You know that there are certain groups in your world who have already made claim for property rights and possession of your moon for the purpose of using it as a military base. Many Earth scientists are hoping that, in the not too distant future, they will succeed in building spaceships like ours for interplanetary travel. It is entirely possible that this will be done. But Earthmen will not be allowed to come in numbers or to remain, until they have learned to embrace the all-inclusive life as lived by people of other worlds, rather than the selfish personal life as found on Earth today. And there will be much for you to learn about outer space, for it is on space itself that you will move." I recalled a simile I had often used, comparing space to a vast ocean in constant motion. And I thought now that, as our ocean liners move on or through the waves of the ocean, so these interplanetary ships move on the waves of the activity in space. "Yes," the Master said, "it is very much like that, and as your scientists work on this principle, more understanding will come to them. For nature herself will reveal her secrets to all who seek with an open mind. As you have been told, we travel space in order to learn. Within our ships are many instruments, some of which you have seen, and many others which you have not yet seen. Although on your Earth you have thrown all our craft into the category of saucers, we have many kinds, many sizes, for many purposes. The largest have never come within the atmosphere of your world. In fact, they have never come within millions of miles of Earth. We cannot risk the lives of the thousands of people traveling in these gigantic ships, for if anything should happen to force a landing on Earth before your people have grown to greater understanding, ours would be in peril. My son, our main purpose in coming to you at this time is to warn you of the great danger which threatens men of Earth today. Knowing more than any amongst you can yet realize, we feel it our duty to enlighten you if we can. Your people may accept the knowledge we hope to give them through you and through others, or they can turn deaf ears and destroy themselves. The choice is with the Earth's inhabitants. We cannot dictate. In your first meeting with our brother here, he indicated to you that the exploding of bombs on Earth was of interest to us. This is why. Even though the power and radiation from the test explosions have not yet gone out beyond your Earth's sphere of influence, these radiations are endangering the life of men on Earth. A decomposition will set in that, in time, will fill your atmosphere with the deadly elements which your scientists and your military men have confined into what you term bombs. The radiations released from those bombs are now going out only so far, since they are lighter than your own atmosphere and heavier than space itself. If, however, Mankind on Earth should release such power against one another in full warfare. A large part of Earth's population could be annihilated, your soil rendered sterile, your waters poisoned and barren to life for many years to come. It is possible that the body of your planet itself could be mutilated to an extent that would destroy her balance in our galaxy. These will be the effects directly concerning your world. For us, traveling through space could be made difficult and dangerous for a long time to come, since the energies released in such multiple explosions would then penetrate through your atmosphere into outer space. I wondered whether, and to what extent, if war should actually come to us, they would feel justified in stopping us. The Master answered my mental question by saying, "As you know, with our knowledge of the use and control over energies far more powerful than any our brothers on Earth have as yet learned to use, we could, if we wished, nullify your force with our greater force. But remember what you have been told. We do not kill our fellow man, even in self-defense. We are trying, and shall continue to try, to prevent such a war by bringing to Earthmen the knowledge of what they would be doing. For no man wages war except in ignorance." A light came into his face and his eyes seemed to be looking at some inward vision of beauty as he continued softly, "And no man lives who has never once dreamed of what you call utopia, or the nearly perfect world. There is nothing which man has ever imagined which is not, somewhere, a reality. And, therefore, nothing that is not possible of achievement. For you too, on Earth, this is possible. For us on the other planets of our galaxy, it is so now. There are those on your Earth who have exclaimed, 'But how monotonous perfection must be!' It is not so, my son, for there are degrees of perfection just as there are degrees of all things. In our worlds, we are happy, but we do not stagnate. Just as when one reaches the top of a hill seen from below, a further hill comes into view, so it is always with progress. The valley that lies between must be crossed before the next height can be scaled. Understanding of the universal laws both uplifts and restricts. As it is now with us, so it could be on your Earth. Lifted up by your knowledge, this same understanding would make it impossible for you to move in violence against your brothers. You would know that the same conviction, inherent in every individual being, which makes him feel that he has the divine privilege of directing his own life and shaping his own destiny, even though it be by the path of trial and error, applies equally to any group, nation or race of mankind. Just as there are many downward paths, leading away from progress, so there are many that lead upward. Though one man may choose one and a second man another, this need not divide them as brothers. Indeed, one may learn much from the other, if he will. For in the vastness of the infinite creation, there is no one way that is the only way. On your Earth we have heard many times the phrase "the road to happiness." It is a good phrase, for progress is happiness and lies all along the upward pathway from its beginning. And happiness makes men brothers in tolerance toward another man's efforts, even though of a different nature from their own. There is nothing wrong with your Earth, nor with its people, except that in their lack of understanding they are young children in the universal life of the One Supreme Being. You have been told that in our world we live the Creator's laws, while as yet on Earth you only talk of them. If you would live by the precepts of even what you now know, the peoples of Earth would not go out to slaughter one another. They would work within themselves, their own groups, their own nations, to achieve good and happiness in that section of your world wherein they were born and therefore call home. I think the peoples of Earth would be amazed to find how swiftly a change could come throughout the planet. Now that you have the medium for worldwide broadcasting, messages urging love and tolerance for all, instead of suspicion and censure, would find receptive hearts. For the great part of the Earth's population is weary of strife and its aftermath of woe. We know that, as never before, they hunger for knowledge of a way of life that will deliver them. We know that there is fear and confusion in their minds because they have seen and felt the results of two great wars that have served only to foster the seeds of another. So, with receptive minds and hearts everywhere on your planet, it is not too late. But there is urgency, my son. So go forth with the blessing of the Infinite Father on your mission, and add your voice to those of others who also carry this message of hope. questions and answers within the ship after a moment of silence during which no one stirred. The master rose, and all present with him. He stood for an instant, his hands resting on the back of his chair, and looked deeply into my eyes. I shall never forget the expression of great kindness and compassion in his gaze. It was like a benediction, and at the same time I felt a new strength rise within me. With a gesture of farewell which embraced all present, he turned then and left the room. The silence remained unbroken for several moments after his departure. I still could find no words. It was Kalna who broke the stillness by saying softly, "For us, too, it is always a privilege to listen to this great being speak." Ram, the Saturnian, deliberately, I am sure, broke the tension. "Now, before we return you to Earth, an interval has been allowed for you to ask questions that may be in your mind. These need not be confined to the serious subject on which the master has just spoken," he added with a smile, "since nothing that interests you will seem trivial to us." I looked at him gratefully as we all resumed our seats. It seemed to me that Ram had meant that I could put my questions orally now, in what was likely to be a general conversation, and not rely on mental telepathy. I voiced the one uppermost in my mind. Could the drastic changes in our atmospheric conditions, in many places since the bomb tests, have anything to do with the release of that energy? They have, indeed, Rama replied, and we are not guessing. Our instruments have registered those results. We know. I wonder, I said slowly, if you would care to comment a little further on the reason why, even though war on our Earth would endanger the traveling through space of millions who live on other planets, you still feel it wrong to hurt the few in order to benefit the many. We will try to explain, Orthon answered. To all of us who have from birth been instilled with a vision of the whole, it is unthinkable to disobey what we know to be the universal laws. These laws are made by no man. They were in the beginning, and will endure throughout eternity. Under these laws, each individual, each group of mankind, all intelligent life on each world, must decide its own destiny without interference from another. Counsel, yes. Instruction, yes. But interference to the point of destruction, never. His questioning look seemed to ask if he had made the principle clearer. Firkn, the Martian, spoke for the first time. You understand the power of thought forms. Apart from our physical missions on Earth, all of us must hold firmly to the belief that the peoples of your Earth will themselves awaken to the disaster toward which they are moving. I see, I said slowly, as the issue did indeed clarify itself in my mind. We knows that the power of this thought continually sent out to all our Earth brothers has changed the hearts of many, Ramu stated. We also are aware, Almuth pointed out, as are you and many other people on your Earth, that your air forces and your governments know that our ships seen in your skies are coming from outer space, and that they can be made and piloted only by intelligent beings from other planets. Men high in the governments of your world have been contacted by us. Some are good men and do not want war. But even the good men on your Earth cannot entirely free themselves from the fear which has been fostered by man himself on your planet throughout the centuries. The same is true of your flyers everywhere on Earth, Kalna said quietly. Many have seen our ships again and again. But they have been muzzled and warned, and few dare speak out. It is the same with your scientists, Firkn added. Again I marveled at their knowledge of our world and its peoples. Then it would seem, I said, that the answer lies largely with the ordinary man in the street, multiplied by his millions the world over. They would be your strength, Firkn quickly agreed. And if they would speak against war in sufficient numbers everywhere, some leaders in different parts of your world would listen gladly. I felt that this conversation had contributed much to my understanding and I was filled with hope. Almost without realizing that I was going to do so, I changed the subject by saying, I wonder if you would explain a little further to me about the mechanism I saw in the pilot's room. The one that registers sounds that are translated into pictures on the screen. Of course, Orthon said. One of its most important uses is to enable us to learn readily any language. Naturally, those of us who actually live and work on your Earth for a while speak with better accents. Although, with us, as with you, Some have a greater aptitude for languages than others and learn to speak flawlessly without any direct contact with the people.